कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी यशोदानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन यशोदानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन जमुना तीरावन चारी जमुना तीरावन चारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी यशोदानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन यशोदानंदन ब्रज जन रंजन जमुना तीरावन चारी जमुना तीरावन चारी Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parivraj Kacharya Ashtotara Shatashish Mad His Divine Grace Abhay Charan Aravinda Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parivraj Kacharya Ashtotara Shatashish Mad His Divine Grace Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Koti Vaishnavrinda Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासरि गौर भक्त वृंद की जय श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गोप गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंद राधा कुंद गिरि गोवर्धन की जय श्री वृंदावन धाम की जय श्री मायापुर धाम की जय श्री जगन्नाथपुरी धाम की जय Ganga Mai Jamuna Mai Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulasi Devi Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Namah Shri Padaya Krishna Krishna Bhutale Shri Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namami Namaste Sarasvati Devai Gurvani Kucharini Nirvashya Shami Paschatyari Shitarine. Thank you. So, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today I will speak about Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but in keeping with tradition, we always like to give some talk about the Bhagavad Gita as it is on these Sunday programs. And just so happens that the chapter that I focused on for this talk has a tie-in with Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It is chapter 2. So I wanted to just choose text number 68 as the jumping-off point for this class. So I'll read the Sanskrit and the verse in purport. Chapter 2, text 68. Tasmat yasya mahabaho nigritani sarvashaha indriyan indriyartebhyas tasya pragya pratishtita. Therefore, O mighty armed one whose senses are restrained from their objects is certainly of steady intelligence. Purport. One can curb the forces of sense gratification only by means of Krishna consciousness, or engaging all the senses in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. As enemies are curbed by superior force, the senses can similarly be curbed not by any human endeavor, but only by keeping them engaged in the service of the Lord. One who has understood this, that only by Krishna consciousness is one really established in intelligence, and that one should practice this art under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, is called sadhaka, or a suitable candidate for liberation. Oma jnana timirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So at the beginning of this chapter 2, Krishna chastises Arjuna, and he says to him, while speaking learned words, you are grieving for what is not worthy of lamentation. You know, the self-realized soul laments neither for the living nor the dead. And so Krishna, in one sense, praises Arjuna, and he uses the term pragyavadams. So this is intelligent words that you've used, because Arjuna comes up with all his rationale why he shouldn't engage in the battle. And then Krishna, in this particular word, uses the same, in this particular shloka, uses the same term, pragya. Pragya means wise words, as we heard before, and pratishtita. Pratishtita means to be situated, to actually be in. Stita means to standing. So pratishtita means very much standing. It's like a superlative. And so one who is really standing in wisdom, he is actually not, he is of steady intelligence, and he's not all disturbed like Arjuna's disturbed in the beginning. So this is the comment that Krishna makes about Arjuna. And then after that, of course, there are so many verses where Krishna describes what is the soul and how the soul operates. And so it's actually from texts 12 to texts 30. So there are like 19 different verses where Krishna describes to Arjuna the nature of the soul, how it cannot be cut by the sword, it cannot be withered by the wind, it cannot, all these things, and that the soul moves through different bodies, he takes on different bodies just like changing clothes. All this very beautiful poetry that Krishna uses to explain to Arjuna this situation of the soul. And then he says, O descendant of Bharata, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. That is in text 30. And then in text 31 through 37, he tells Arjuna, look, you are a Kshatriya. You have a certain Svadharma. Dharma means that essence of being, the essence of who you are. And Sva means your personal essence of who you are. So he said, you have a specific Svadharma. You are, according to the modes of nature, you are situated in the body of a Kshatriya. And you will not be happy unless you fulfill that Dharma. And so therefore it's useless for you to speak about quitting the battle and taking and becoming a renunciate. This is just foolishness on your part. And you will not be happy. And people, instead of praising you, they will be very dismissive of you. They will call you a coward. They will simply disregard you and carry on with this bloodbath that is going to take place anyway. So why you're adopting this false position that you have, and you will lose all your reputation. And not only that, you're arguing about killing your guru, but your guru has actually trained you up to do this. This is what he's trained you, Dronacharya. He may be your enemy in the battle, but he is your guru, and he has trained you in these principles of how you should behave and what you should do and what you should not do. And so therefore, you should fight. So, on text 39, Krishna says, this is a summary of what is called Sankhya Yoga. And so, if you look at most Indian texts of the Bhagavad Gita, most translations of the Bhagavad Gita, all the different chapters have different titles. And the titles are according to the different kinds of yoga. So you have a Karma Yoga chapter, you have a Jnana Yoga chapter, you have a Purushottama Yoga chapter, and so on. And so in most texts, this chapter is called Sankhya Yoga, because this is what Krishna is referring to by this definition of the soul. Sankhya means to summarize, and to not exactly summarize, but to, let me just see, it means that which describes things in detail. And sometimes it is called like counting. Sankhya is another word for counting. So you count the different elements in a situation, just like you count the different senses, you count the sense objects, you count the elements, your earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. There's a counting of all these different things, all these different elements that go to make up the human or the spiritual situation. So this is the Sankhya Yoga. And so then there are a number of different verses in which Krishna explains to Arjuna that, you know, according to the Shastra, you were quoting your Dharma in the beginning, but I'm telling you that the Dharma is that for the Kshatriyas, nothing is more happy than to get a chance to fight on the battlefield. And you should take it that way. And you should be enthused to take it that way. And there's a famous verse, Neha Bikramana Shosti, Svalpam Apyasya Dharmasya Trayate Mahato Bahyat, that in following this path, there's no loss of diminution. And even a little progress on this path is very advantageous. And Vyavasayatmika Budhi Ekeha Kurunandana, that the people who have a fixed consciousness, their intelligence is focused, and they're not diverted by these false dharmas, these false arguments against doing one's duty. And he even, Krishna even refers to the Vedas. He actually, what's the term, the modern term, he disses the Vedas, you know. Where he says that the Vedas, Krishna, this is not me, so. He says that the Vedas, people of small intelligence, actually, they enjoy the flowery words of the Vedas. See? But he said that the Vedas are there according to the three modes of material nature. The Vedas are given for people to make advancement in Krishna consciousness. But he says, Nistrai Gunya Bhavarjuna, you have to transcend the three modes of material nature in order to truly achieve the goal of human life. And so therefore, in a sense, these are flowery words of the Vedas, but you've got to forget about it. You've got to simply follow your Svadharma. You have to follow your specific route to Krishna consciousness. And then in text 54, Arjuna asks, he has a very important question, and he says, O Krishna, what are the symptoms of one who is in this consciousness, whose consciousness is thus merged in transcendence? How does he speak and what is his language? How does he sit and how does he walk? And this sitting, again, is this word sthita. How does he situate himself? It's not actually just sitting on a chair or something. It's actually how you've positioned yourself in this life. And Krishna's answer is amazing. He says, O Partha, when a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, and when his mind thus purified finds satisfaction in the self alone, he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness. So the interesting thing is the word mental concoction. And in this clause is mano gatan. Gata means to travel to somewhere, and mano means the mind. That the mind travels to all kinds of different places out of a desire for sense gratification. So that's the key to a transcendental person. And then in the final texts of the chapter, Krishna explains the nature of the senses and how to overcome them. And it's very poetic. He says, just as a lamp, or a candle, you might say, a lamp meaning a flame, does not waver in a windless place, so a man's mind in fixed consciousness is not swayed. And in comparison also to the tortoise, just as the tortoise withdraws his limbs, so a man in fixed consciousness withdraws his senses from the sense objects. And then he says, just as a boat on the water is swept away by even one of the senses, right? So similarly, just as a strong wind sweeps away a boat on the water, even attraction to one of the senses can sweep away the intelligence. The mind will sweep away the intelligence. So, as we carry on, we get to the final verse of the chapter, and this is where the relationship comes in. Srila Prabhupada, in the purport of this chapter, says that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has summarized this second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as being the contents for the whole text. In the Bhagavad Gita, the subject matters are Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. And in the second chapter, Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga have been clearly discussed, and a glimpse of Bhakti Yoga has been given as the contents for the complete text. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada, in translating this Bhagavad Gita as it is, and presenting these commentaries, his commentary has entitled this chapter "The Contents of the Gita Summarized," as in recognition of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's title or description of this chapter. So, this is the segue into the life of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is there's a quote by Srila Prabhupada that I just wanted to read as a start off. Srila Prabhupada once said that we should take it that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the origin of the Krishna consciousness movement in its pure form. So this is the stature of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur for our understanding of Krishna consciousness. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur appeared in the year 1838 in the town and the village of Birnagar. Birnagar is about two or three stops on the train line before you reach Krishnanagar, which is usually the jumping off point for the devotees to go to Mayapur Dham. And Birnagar, there is still a place there that was the place of one of his sons who lived there during Srila Prabhupada's time, and Srila Prabhupada did visit there with Lalit Prasad Thakur, the son of Srila Bhaktivinoda. And so in his autobiography, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes his early life as one of extreme opulence. His family was very, very wealthy. They had soldiers guarding their compound, and they would hold massive Durga Puja festivals. Durga is very popular in Bengal and is the worshipable deity for the Shakta sect of West Bengal. And he described, you know, all the amazing, all the big sacrifices that would go on, and how there were many Brahmins who would come for these festivals, and they would have a lot of Harikatha that would go on as a matter of course during all the different festivals that they would hold. And he would listen and enjoy very much the Hari Kirtan, as he describes it in his autobiography. And he was very much enlivened by this kirtan process. But at that time, there was not much philosophy going on. There was not much preaching going on in terms of the philosophy of either of Krishna consciousness or of what you might call generic Hinduism. But there was a lot of ritual, and there was a lot of kirtan, and there were many descriptions and lectures on the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. And so these stories of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, they were his youth. And being from a very wealthy family, of course, he was educated. And so, but the fashion was that, seeing they were under British rule, that they would be educated in the British fashion. And so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he went to various different schools, and by the age of 18, 19, he entered college, what is now Calcutta University. It was then called some Hindu charitable school, something like that. I forget exactly the name. And at that time, he met with the intelligentsia of Bengal, especially one Vijendranath Tagore. The Tagores became a very famous family because the youngest brother of Vijendranath, Rabindranath Tagore, won the Nobel Prize for poetry. And so they were a very influential family, and in their heritage they established universities and schools and this kind of thing, because they were also very much involved with the British administration at the time. Anyway, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he befriended this family. He was a friend of Vijendranath, the oldest brother, the Borodada. And so he was also introduced at that time to different British people, and was publishing and writing poetry in the English language. That saw a very good audience from the British people that were there, as well as the Bengali intellectual class. And this class, they were called the Bhadra Lok, Lok means people, and Bhadra means auspicious, the auspicious people. So the Bhadra Lok, they became the leaders of Bengal's intellectual society, and they also became the administrators of the British Empire. Because what happened was, there was in 1859, 57, 58, 59, the first Indian War of Independence. That was at the time referred to by the British as the Sepoy Mutiny, the mutiny of the soldiers. At that time, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was 19 or 20 years old. And so what happened was that previously the British had ruled India through the British East India Company. But because of this mutiny, the British government decided to take it over from by the government. And so therefore they started to enlist various intelligent, intellectual Indian men who were educated in the English way to become part of the British administration. And so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he became one of these individuals. He was one of the individuals recruited by the British, although previously he had been a school teacher and headmaster of a school. Actually, there's a funny story that at first he tried to get a job with a sugar merchant. And so this sugar merchant hired him. And after he had done one transaction, this person who was supplying the sugar brought him an extra bag of sugar, see? And he considered this very dishonest, you know, and there was all kinds of, and he could see all this kind of bribery and corruption going on. So finally his boss told him, look, you're not cut out for this work. You should do something else. You should become a school teacher. And so he did, actually. So it's a nice story. So there's an interesting story about his grandfather. His grandfather was a yogi. And when he was about 20 years old, his grandfather called for him. And his grandfather told him, I'm going to die very soon, and I want you to take care of all the business of the family business and the properties that we own, things like that, because I'm going to die. And Bhaktivinoda in his autobiography says he was very surprised because the man looked very fit and very conscious and very clear. And but once, after 3 days, once he had settled the business of the family, the man adopted the yoga position and left his body through the Brahmarandra chakra, and he was a true yogi. He also predicted to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur that when you're 27 years old, you will find your position in life, and you will get your post that you want. And this indeed happened. At the age of 27, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur received his first situation as a deputy magistrate in an area called Chapra, which is now in Bihar, for the British administration. And a couple of years later, he was transferred to a place called Dinajpur. Dinajpur is sort of on the border between Bangladesh and West Bengal. And it's interesting that Bangladesh, as we know as Bangladesh today, there are four pockets of Vaishnavism in Bangladesh, just as an aside. And this Dinajpur was in the northeast section of Bangladesh. The northwest corner of Bangladesh has the place of Lord Chaitanya's birthplace, Sylhet, which is the ancestral home of Lord Chaitanya. The southeast has Chittagong, which is the place of the Vaishnavas, still a place of the Vaishnavas. Actually, one of our devotees comes from there. Is he here? Anyway. And then the southwest corner with Benapol, which is where Haridas Thakur had his Bhajan Kutir. So these four corners of Bangladesh, they are ancestral homes of the Vaishnavas. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this, because Vaishnavism was very strong there, it was in Dinajpur that he received his first copy of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he was so, at first, he was impressed. And after the second reading, he was convinced that Lord Chaitanya is the greatest pundit, the greatest, most brilliant avatar of Krishna. And by then he was convinced. Because up until then, he had not much contact, not much association with Vaishnava literature at all. He was trained up in Western philosophical thought. He was very enamored of the Unitarians, for example, because many of the Americans, American intelligentsia were Unitarians, and he read all their literature. And he read also Western philosophers like Hegel and Kant and Aristotle, Plato, and so on. And there is even a book that Srila Bhaktivinoda wrote after some years, in which he called Tattva Viveka, which is the path of truth, the translation is the path of truth, in which he examines all the Western philosophies and all the Eastern philosophies and puts them up to the scrutiny of Lord Chaitanya's philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, of dualism. So this is the one of the features. So in Dinajpur, he became a convert, you might say, just as in some ways we who have been educated in the West have become converts to Krishna consciousness through the teachings of Srila Prabhupada. So in the same way, to some degree anyway, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also a convert to Krishna consciousness. And there's so many things in his life, it's hard to actually begin. In 1871, around there, he was transferred to Jagannath Puri, and he became the deputy magistrate in Jagannath Puri. And part of the one of the things the British administration recruited him to do was to manage the affairs of the Puri temple. They understood the significance of the Jagannath Puri temple to the local Hindu population, but they needed someone to bring it, to keep it together. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he instituted regular prasadam offerings, 64 offerings daily to Lord Jagannath. And he also clamped down on certain corrupt practices that were going on at the time. And this is one feature of his rule. When he was there also, he put down a very famous and very powerful yogic black yogi, you might call him, a yogi of the black arts, who was practicing Rasa Leela and all kinds of perversions of Krishna consciousness. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was able to defeat him, despite the fact that he had tremendous following, and he personally had many siddhis and many powers, yogic powers. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was able to defeat him merely by chanting the holy names and by actually arresting him, which was not an easy thing to do, and making sure that he received the justice of the time. And so, also, he discovered the original birthplace of Lord Chaitanya The present town of Navadvip, which was at that time accepted as the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, was, when he examined the various maps of the time that were taken, he understood that this town of Navadvip was only 100 years old. And Lord Chaitanya had appeared some 350, 400 years before. So this town could not be the actual birthplace. And through study of the maps, he understood that he would have to find the actual birthplace. And so when he took up his position as the district magistrate of Krishnanagar, the Krishnanagar district, he spent some time in Navadvip, and from the roof of one of the dharmshalas in Navadvip, he saw a golden apparition on the other side of the river Ganges. And he sort of couldn't believe his eyes. And so the next day, he immediately went to that place, and he was accompanied by Srila Jagannath Das Babaji, who was at that time 120 years old and had to be carried around in a palanquin because he could not really move on his own. And upon reaching the place where he had seen this golden apparition, Srila Jagannath Das Babaji jumped from the palanquin and started chanting that this is the place of Lord Chaitanya. And so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur then established this place as what we know now as the Yogapith of Lord Chaitanya. This is a legacy that we have from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. A very important thing that he did was he exposed the upper sampradayas of Vaishnavism. He cataloged them, he described them, and he pointed out their flaws. After Lord Chaitanya's disappearance, there were many branches of Vaishnavism developed. And so these branches, some would follow the principles, some would not. Some would do rasa lila kinds of things like this yogi in Jagannath Puri. And so there were all kinds of perversions of the original philosophy of Lord Chaitanya. And so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he exposed these, he described them, and basically he reestablished the reputation of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Because of these different cults, these upper sampradayas, Gaudiya Vaishnavism had become very much in disrepute. And it was regarded as a terrible kind of subcult with all kinds of weird practices. And so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the first pioneer to eradicate this impression of Vaishnavism that people had. And so he did this by establishing the Namahata movement. In his time, he established, it is described as, over 500 Namahata sanghas throughout Bengal and Orissa. So these Namahatas, they were congregations of devotees who were chanting the holy name. And he called himself the sweeper of the market of the holy name. So the market of the holy name had these different titles. The treasurer would be Lord Nityananda, and so on, and the different Advaita, Lord Sri Advaita would be another functionary in this Namahata Sangha. And but he regarded himself as the lowly sweeper of the market of the holy name. And then, of course, he translated many commentaries and published many books on Vaishnavism, because he understood that things had been lost. So much of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness had become lost or perverted due to impure commentaries and impure practices. And so he wrote It's described approximately 100 books, 100 volumes, and this is apart from articles and essays and so on and so forth, that almost 100 books. So I just wanted to also outline how he did this, because it's very interesting that his son, Lalit Prasad, gave a description of what his daily schedule was like. And so, actually, he starts in the evening. He says, between 7:30 and 8 p.m., he would take rest. He would go to bed. And he would arise just before 10 p.m., could say three hours later, light his oil lamp, right? There was no electricity in those days, and write books until 4 a.m. Then he would rest again for a maximum of half an hour. At 4:30 a.m., he would wash his hands and face, sit down, and chant on his beads. He never showed his beads to anyone, but would chant on them constantly as time permitted. At 7 a.m., he answered all his correspondence. At 7:30 a.m., he read various religious and philosophical works. And at 8:30 a.m., he received visitors, if any, or else he would continue to read until 9:30 a.m. At that time, he would walk back and forth on the veranda of his house and contemplate different religious questions and solve them in his mind. And sometimes he would solve them by arguing back and forth with himself as he paced along his veranda, and as if preaching to some unseen guest. He would rest briefly from 9:30 to 9:45 a.m., 15 minutes, then take bath and breakfast, which usually consisted of a half quart of milk, two chapatis, and some fruit. At 9:55 a.m., he would don his uniform and leave for court in his carriage. As a magistrate, he wore coat and pants. On his neck were six strands of large tulsi beads. He was resolute in his court decisions, and he would decide a case immediately, not tolerating any humbug. He did his business and left. He shaved his head monthly and never cared what anybody thought about it. The lawyers and the Englishmen were astounded by his capacity for work. At 10 a.m., court began. He would hear between 30 and 50 cases per day, and yet he finished by 1 p.m. What took other magistrates a half hour, he finished in 5 minutes. He took another 2 minutes to write the judgment in detail, and actually it's interesting, it says here, some of his superiors became envious and tried to discourage him because there was a lot of racism at the time. And if the British saw an Indian person becoming, you know, prominent or being, you know, very efficient or like that, they would try to undermine him. And there was one, in fact, his name was Sir William Duke. And later on, after Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had retired, Sir William Duke actually came to visit him and apologized. He said, "I know I put a lot of obstacles in your way at the time, and I would like to apologize for that." And so this is a measure of the times. And then, so at 1 p.m., he went home, refreshed himself, and then returned to work from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Every evening after his court duties, Bhaktivinoda Thakur would translate some Sanskrit religious work into Bengali by dictating it to a secretary. Then there was an evening bath and meal consisting of a little rice, two chapatis, and another half quart of milk. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur worked with a pocket watch so that everything he did was on schedule. Despite heavy domestic and official responsibilities, his every moment was embellished with an intense desire to render service to the Lord. So, we have so much. And then, of great import for our Krishna consciousness movement and our ISKCON society, is that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he predicted the advent of a great devotee who would come and spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world. And this, we understand, is the prediction of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada notes that 1896 was the year of his birth, and it was also the year in which Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur sent his first book, the Precepts and Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, to different intellectuals and educational institutions in the West. And we know one of the devotees, he discovered one of these copies at the McGill University in Canada. And so this Srila Prabhupada himself noted the serendipity or the coincidence of this and considered it significant for his preaching work also, that he had this bond with Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in this way. And of course, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he prayed to Krishna to have a son who would carry on the preaching of Krishna consciousness. And we know that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was born to him as a result of this prayer of his to Krishna. And as we know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is the our grand spiritual master and the spiritual master of Srila Prabhupada. And in 1908, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he took Babaji initiation from Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji. Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji was very reluctant because he considered that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was his spiritual master. So that is a nice pastime. And then from 1910 until his departure on June 23rd of 1914, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur stayed in Samadhi in the Bhakti Bhavan, his house in Calcutta. And if I could repeat again, we should take it that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the origin of the Krishna consciousness movement in its pure form. So, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai! Hare Krishna. So, are there any questions? Yes, Prabhu. Is there a mic by any chance? No, I guess it's not working. Oh, they'll switch it on short.
When Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was at Bhakti Bhavan, Gaurakishore Das Babaji sent a message to him. Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji would not write, but he would dictate and somebody would write. And the message said that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you should actually not stay in Calcutta. There's too much Maya there. You should come to Mayapur. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote back, there's no question of Maya existing where I am.
Jai.
And it was also nice about the British. They actually, although some were envious, some were very respectful of
him. Some were very positive, yes.
And one of them wrote a letter of reference, of recommendation. And he said that, I cannot remember his name now, but he said that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a very honest man, high integrity, highly efficient. And at the end he wrote, and I'm honored to be your servant.
Wow.
He closed the letter like that, I'm honored to be your servant. So for a British man to say something like this.
Actually, the story of Sir William Duke also is interesting, that one of the things that he said was, one of the reasons I was so much against you was because if there were more like you, I was afraid that the British would be kicked out.
And on his departure, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta wanted to be there with him, but there was a flood and the trains were not running, so he could not go from Calcutta to from Mayapur to Calcutta. So when he got there, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur had already left his body. But his mother was there, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's mother was there, and she told him that your father had great expectations from you.
Yes. Jai. Yes, Prabhu, behind. You give the mic. Jai, thank you.
Thank you for the class. Jai, Srila Prabhupada. The three-volume set that came out on Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is very good, but it's like you got to chug through it really rough. The two things I just want to share, and I appreciate your lesson, is just to highlight it, I won't keep it long. It's when Bhaktisiddhanta went to Gorkhishor Das Babaji, which I love to say that word, he finally got initiated, and I believe Gorkhishor touched his head with his feet, and he said he was in ecstasy for days, just in total ecstasy. And the other thing is, there was a show on PBS a number of years ago about the history of India, and they came to the section of the British occupation, and the gentleman who narrates the show is British, and he did a very good job. I would encourage everyone to see it if they can get it on DVD. He comes to the point where you're at in the 1800s. He comes also to the time of the partitioning, and he regrets it as a gentleman of the British nationality that what happened in India. And the one thing he says is he calls to partitioning that the British gave the Indians their divorce before their marriage. And so I'll leave it at that, but thank you again for your class.
Hare Krishna. Yes.
I was wondering if you would elaborate a little more on the relationship between Gorkhishor Das Babaji Maharaj and Srila Bhaktivedanta Thakur.
To elaborate on the relationship, one thing to note is that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur throughout his life met and had the association of what you might call the entire Gaudiya Vaishnav world at the time. And so in that sense, he was very much, at least in a certain respect, he understood who the cheaters were, he understood who the righteous were, and he understood what was the true nature of spiritual advancement. And this relationship was based largely that they had much association together. I mean, you would have to read, it's actually not spelled out very much in the books that I've read what the relationship exactly was, other than that they were very close and very respectful of each other, and that Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji, as I say, considered Srila Bhaktivinoda to be his spiritual master. And we accept that in our parampara line that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is the spiritual master of Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji, who is the spiritual master of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is the spiritual master of our Srila Prabhupada. So, but as to how much relationship they had, Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji would attend many programs that were held by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. That's there in the literature. And but Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji was a very private person, and he shunned crowds, and he did not want to be worshipped or in any way recognized. And so this is a kind of a very peculiar manifestation of a pure devotee, that he considers himself the most fallen. And certainly Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji mentioned this. Actually, there was one story that I read in the book, that when Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was approaching him to take this Babaji initiation, he couldn't find Srila Gorkhishor. He went to the place where Srila Gorkhishor Das Babaji normally stayed, but Srila Gorkhishor wasn't there. And so afterward, the next day, Srila Gorkhishor was mentioned to someone, I cheated Bhaktivinoda. I went to that Mataji's house, and I sat by that Mataji's house so that he couldn't find me. You know. So that's one. So they had some kind of relationship of like that. I don't know.
Ranjit Prabhu?
Yes.
Not to prolong the class session I was just discussing and wondering, is there any indication from the time when Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the magistrate at the Puri temple as to when this ruling of Westerners not being allowed in the Puri, if that was during his time or if he had any direct connection with that?
Sorry, if what particular...
When he was the magistrate, manager of the Puri temple, you know, of course now Westerners are not allowed in. Did this come after his time, or was this something upheld during his time? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything in particular about that, but I would assume that the policy of the temple was to keep people out from time immemorial. Especially, there's also the Muslim-Hindu thing that Muslims would not be allowed in either. So then that ruling would have applied to Westerners automatically. Yeah. So I don't think that was something initiated by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I can't see that. Yes, Prabhu.
Thing that comes to mind, it's not related to this, but Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he started learning English from the age of 5. And his first English teacher was actually French.
That's correct, yeah.
And he used to wear dhoti, and he liked dal and chapati.
The what party?
He used to wear dhoti. His French teacher,
yeah.
He used to wear dhoti, and he liked dal and chapati.
Dal and chapati.
And also, at the age of 10, he met one Muslim man who was a shoemaker. And this man told him, sex only when you are married, and once a month.
Oh.
That's in his Swalihita Jivani biography.
Yeah, one of the more colorful items of his childhood was that there was a guard, one of the guards, one of the soldiers who would guard them, had previously been a dacoit, a thief and a bandit. But this man, he would only chant the name of Ram, and he would only tell stories from the Ramayana. And the story was that this man, when he was a dacoit, they had attacked some place and to pillage and rob some place, and he cut a person's head off, and that person happened to be his guru. And so, therefore, I don't know why he never got tried for murder, or, you know, what the court system was or wasn't like it at that time, but because of that, he just was basically took sannyas, but he had to work, and so he got it. That was one of his services as a guard for Bhaktivinoda's family. They were, as we say, fabulously wealthy at the time, but they lost everything. His family lost everything, and so he had to attend school while he was living with relatives, uncles and like that. And when he was in Calcutta, his family, certain parts of his family, they had leased the Fort William property to the British East India Company. That was the source of their wealth, was their property, the area of Calcutta.
I have one more comment, if I
can. Okay.
He got married at the age of 12.
That's right, yes.
And when he got married, he was taken to the house of his father-in-law.
Yeah.
But he did not want to go alone. He wanted his babysitter to come with him.
Yeah, right. He described that in his autobiography. It was just like a doll wedding. Like you'd have dolls, and you'd have your dolls, and you'd marry the two dolls. So he said that was the description of his marriage at the age of 12, and I think the girl was 5 years old. So it was that. Yeah. So those were the customs of the times. Yes. Yeah.
My daughter here just reminded me that in one of the publications by Madhavananda Prabhu, who is a devotee who lives in Bhuvaneshwar and is very expert on the whole history of the Jagannath Temple. He discusses how it was the British who actually made that rule because they didn't want their people to go in and be influenced by the devotion.
Ah, that's interesting. Ah, the Brits. What can you do, huh? Yes.
We just heard this morning in Krishna House that when Bhaktivinoda Thakur wanted to retire early, he said he wanted to go live in Mayapur. And so the British said, no, don't. We'll extend the rail line to Mayapur.
That's right.
We'll build, and so you can still see the tracks, you know, by his house. And,
yes, you know, it's called a toy train. Just like the trains that go up to Darjeeling. They're very narrow. They're a 2 feet gauge. And so the British built a 2 foot gauge train to Godrum, where Bhaktivinoda Thakur's house is. You can still ride on the train, I think. I don't know. You could when I was... 2 years ago, you still could do that, yeah. It's
also
not very efficient, though.
The Thakur was really good at engaging popular things of the day. Like, if you go to Mayapur, the locals swear that the tune that we sing for Jai Radha Madhava was a Bengali wedding tune.
Oh.
That the Thakur appropriated to glorify the supreme couple.
Yeah.
So he wrote Jai Radha Madhava. They swear that's true.
Yeah. I know there's a very popular tune that we use in ISKCON that comes from a Hindi movie also, but anyway, we won't go there.
And also, the Thakur, when he wrote the famous 22-23 stanza poem, Saragrahi Vaishnav, Alas for those who spend their days in festive mirth and joy. That was a very popular poetic meter of the day amongst British and American poets. The Thakur appropriated that and did it better than they did. In fact, one day in the shower I discovered you can sing that song to the tune of America the Beautiful. And my most happy moment in Swananda Sukada Kunj, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's house, I got to sing that whole poem he wrote to the Thakur, to the tune of America the Beautiful. I thought, you know, he would like that because he was so up to date.
He was very up to date. That is one of the things, is that he was very well educated and very well read in all things Western, which is phenomenal, actually.
And we hear he had correspondence with Emerson, I believe.
Emerson, yes. Yeah. But it seems like it was, you
short-lived.
Know, short. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And actually, there's so many things, and I get a lot out of this book, The Seventh Goswami by Rupa Vilas Prabhu. It's a very excellent book. And also, I had the opportunity a long time ago to read Svalikita Jivani, that's the autobiography of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which he wrote to his son Lalit Prasad. In 1896, Lalit Prasad had questioned him about some things, and so Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote this autobiography, but he said that this is a confidential and not to publicize too much these things, because they're not... people will start to take it very... that the guru is an ordinary person, that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur is an ordinary person, had an ordinary job, had an ordinary family and an ordinary life, and you know, like that. But we can understand in Krishna consciousness that he had a very extraordinary personality and life. So we're fortunate in that way that we can appreciate these kinds of revelations of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna.